From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
I'm thrilled to welcome back to the show today one of the great voices in the history of popular music, Colin Blunstone. He's the leader of the Zombies, whose hits include Time of the Season, She's Not There, Tell Her No, Leave Me Be, Whenever You're Ready, and so many more. And joining Colin Blunstone is Robert Schwartzman, the actor, producer, director, and he's directed a new film called Hung Up on a Dream, the Zombies documentary, in which the zombies tell their own story. Colin Blunstone and Robert Schwartzman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for having us on the show.
I love this movie. It really captures the joy of the zombies. It looked like it was a lot of fun to make. Robert Schwartzman, did you find the zombies anxious to share their story?
To me, I wanted to learn by doing, right? I mostly learn by doing. But, you know, I've always loved the music from the Zombies, and I've known some stories here and there. But for me, this was like a discovery mission as well as making a film. I was getting to live and discover as the audiences, right? So I, as a filmmaker, I think what you are is you're creating, you're laying the pieces out, and you're coming up with things conceptually as a way of how am I going to tell this story, right? And there's a lot of history here. We're dealing with like over 60 years of a band's history, of the individual's history. And you're squeezing it in about 90 minutes of a film, a feature length film.
Yeah.
So yeah, you have to pick and choose what works, what is the story, finding the themes, what's the sort of undercurrent story that you keep coming back to in here? That, what am I really telling? Because I'm not doing a special, like a VH1 behind the scenes where I'm just kind of telling you about, oh, we use this Gibson. I mean, it's great and I love that series, but we need to go further. And also I kept saying to the guys, like, you know, you've made such great music that people love, songwriting, performance, recording style. This movie has to be kind of live up to what we all want from a zombies movie, like what we all crave musically from you and what we're going to experience from like a filmmaking perspective. And, you know, we maybe you've read pieces here and there about limited archival, these kinds of things, but that was the filmmaking fun of it for me, was just how are we telling the story? And I think you learn as you go, and you learn, and that's where you have to stay open to finding the little story elements that will ultimately keep the audience engaged. But really, I'm just like you. I'm just like everyone in that audience. I'm just here to watch something and be taken away on an emotional level and hopefully walk away feeling something new and learning something new.
Well, I hope there's a whole lot of bonus outtakes for the Blu-ray.
There's so much stuff. It's like, we could have made like, yeah, like a whole series about this like band. So,
well, I hope you'll make that available to us. You know, the film begins with this wonderful a cappella vocal by Colin Blunstone singing The Way I Feel Inside. And I was thinking, oh, this is a lovely recording from 60 years ago. But no, Colin Blunstone, it's you right now. I don't want to say your age or anything, but you're not 20 years old anymore. But you still sound like you are. What do you do to maintain your singing voice?
Well, I do have quite a strict regimen that I do, especially when we're on the road. And I will do like a 30-minute warm-up before soundcheck and a 30-minute warm-up before the show. So I will have sung for over an hour before the show starts. And other thing, it's just common sense otherwise. The main thing is to make sure that you have enough water, really. It's something I didn't understand when I was younger, you know, that you have to stay hydrated. I mean, in life you do, but as a singer especially, look after your diet and get plenty of sleep. None of those late night parties, you know, that's all in the past. And so that's how I do it. I'm sure everyone's got their own way of doing it. But I just try and, as I said, mostly it's common sense. Just look after my voice the best I can.
Did you have any reservations about doing a beautiful a cappella opening like that? It was very brilliant.
Well, it's really interesting. But from memory, I don't think I really knew what we were doing in this church. I mean, Robert might remember it differently. But we were in this church and I wasn't quite sure why we were there. And then, of course, Rod started playing this huge church organ. It's really loud. And I didn't have any microphone or anything. And I thought, boy, I'm going to be a bit up against it here. But it was great fun to do. And very imaginative as well. Whoever thought up that scene, I think it's wonderful. But from my point of view, I'm not sure I really understood what was going on until it was, okay, we're doing this song and now start, you know.
How did you feel about making this film and about sharing your memories?
Well, Rob and I sat down and talked, and it was obvious that Robert has a huge energy and a great knowledge of making films. And on top of that, he's a very sophisticated musician as well. And it really helped. And he also knew a lot about the zombies. So it was an interesting conversation, our first conversation we had about it. But I mean, he won us over immediately. I thought it would be great for the history of the band to have a sophisticated film made of our journey from 1961 up until, and particularly till 2019 and our induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a film that would describe that journey that we've been on? And so it was a very easy decision for us to make this film with Robert. I'm so glad that we did.
Well, except for when Laurence Olivier turns off the TV and Bunny Lake is missing.
I know. Yes, it took me a little while to get over that, really. It was a sensitive moment for me, yeah. I remember we spent, I think, 2 whole days recording those songs with Otto Preminger, who is a draconian slave master. So it was interesting, but a bit of an ordeal. So we go through these 2 days of recording to record these films, and Laurence Olivier gets up out of his chair and turns us off when we're in our full glory. But it was nice to be in a film and to share billing with Laurence Olivier and Carol Lynley.
It's a lovely
and film. The zombies. Yeah.
But why did the zombies never make a Hard Day's Night or Help or a Wild Weekend or Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter? Why didn't you ever make a movie like those guys did?
Well, I mean, to put it in a nutshell, I don't think we were ever offered the opportunity to do it. I mean, it's a nice thought. But, obviously our career path just went in a different direction. If we'd have had a real opportunity to do that, I'm sure we would have at least considered it. Whether we would have done it or not, I don't know. I think the acting potential in our band was probably a little bit limited. But we would have thought about it if we'd been offered the opportunity.
And if she should tell you, come closer. Colin Blunstone, in your new film, Hung Up on a Dream, the zombies documentary, you answer a question that's always puzzled me about Tell Her No. There's a lyric in there that I've never been able to understand. And I found out in watching the movie that you were asleep when you recorded it.
And if she should tell you, I love you, whoa, whoa. If she tempts you with a charm, down loving love from your arms. Down hurt me now, for her love belongs to me.
So it's in the second chorus of Tell Her No, and I just mumble through the second chorus of Tell Her No. It's because, yeah, we used to record through the night, and while the guys were doing the backing tracks, I mean, they were really quick. We would have done 4 or 5 tracks, and probably wouldn't have started till 7. This was closer to 12, I suppose. And they woke me up and said, okay, you got to sing now. And I went out and did Tell Her No, and I mumbled this line. And I said to the producer, look, come, I just drop in and replace that line. It doesn't make any sense. And he just said, don't worry about that. No, it's fine, it's fine. And the record, I think, went to number 6 in the charts and sold close on 1 million copies. So he probably knew what he was talking about. I thought it would have been nice to at least have all the words correct, but it wasn't to be.
for 60 years. But now when you sing it live, do you purposefully mumble as you did on the record?
No, I don't. To my shame, I lose the authenticity of my vocal performance. And I do actually shove a line in there that I've sort of made up myself that makes some kind of sense.
Well, I know you did some songwriting. You didn't write that one. But I just recently discovered this Jillian Hills record where she does a cover of Leave Me Be in French. And I wonder, were there a lot of covers of zombie songs? Was that a lucrative thing for you guys?
There were quite a lot of covers of zombie songs. I mean, more famously, perhaps Santana did She's Not There. Mm-hmm. Cher very recently did This Will Be Our Year. Oh. These ones that just spring to mind, but there were many covers. And in fact, the writers in the band, the primary writers, Rod Argent and Chris White, I think, you know, that they were really in a slightly different world to us, because the world of songwriters is very different. They were getting covers, and the income stream from writing was very accurate to them. And so they were in a completely different financial situation to us. The Zombies as a touring entity really never made any money at all through various, I mean, it happened to lots of bands in the 60s. It's not just us. It's not a hard luck story. It's a growing up story. It's a live and learn story. And we didn't make any money. And that was a part of the reason why the band finished in 1967.
Did that inspire you to be a songwriter? Because I know you wrote.
Yes, it did partly. Not particularly the finances of it, but watching Rod and Chris hone their craft did inspire me to become a songwriter. And, you know, and I have written many songs since then.
Oh, yes. And on your solo albums as well.
All right. Okay.
Which I love, your solo records. But I also love this Zombies record, New World. It's got a song in here that's one of my favorites, Lula Lula. You sing it so beautifully. You should put this on your set. You should sing this song again.
It's a beautiful song. It's a Chris White song. Yeah, and I think that's a nickname for his first wife, Lula Lula. Yeah, it's a great song. And I think Rod hums like a trombone solo in there. So if there's if you hear a sort of a trombone solo, that's Rod Argent humming.
Has it been a great experience now promoting this movie and getting people to see it?
Totally. I mean, it's like a really cool experience to be able to get to know the guys in the band so well and spend time with them. And it's just a nice, you know, it's a very like grounding human experience, like getting to collaborate on a doc. Because, you know, scripted film, it's, you know, not all scripted films are based on fiction, but when you're working with a screenplay with actors and you have a schedule and you shoot a film, it's a different way of telling stories. When you're telling a story about someone's like life or experiences, it's a totally different thing to cut that and work on that. So it's really brought me closer to them, even if it's just like me in the editing room guy, you know, not with Colin every day, but you experience people differently when you're working on a film because you're staring at their face all day long, watching things over and over and over again. It's pretty like wild if you sat with in an edit room. But yeah, it's been, I'm just happy, you know, if you zoom out, I'm just happy that we're here talking about the film. We're celebrating the zombies, that, you know, the next generation, I'm the next generation of other generations. So, and there's other generations after me. So it's kind of like me doing my part past, you know, in this relay race of life, of sharing ideas, right?
Yeah.
I'm doing my part by handing my excitement about music and stories to the next generation. So I'm just happy people are going to get to discover this movie and this band in this kind of way. And I think that a film about an art, we did things that were film-like, like going into the church, finding that big pipe organ in Brooklyn, and doing that singing from the like second, like, you know, the balcony of the church. Like those moments, I think, are meant to be more of like a conceptual way of filmmaking around a documentary. And it, to me, it's like, how do you make a cinematic? I wanted the film to be cinematic, like not just feel like a text, like we're opening up page chapter 3 in a textbook, but there's something else going on here. Like cutting in and out of the jukebox shots we got, or the vinyl spinning. It's okay. Those kinds of things that take you through history. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, it feels like a great experience so far. And it's my first documentary. I've made scripted films, my first doc, and I've been bit by the bug of documentaries. So I'd love to make another doc at some point. But I'm just happy. I'm as Colin is too. I'm a people pleaser, as Colin says in the film. Mm-hmm. I want people to like the movie. I want people to like the show. I want people to like the song. I want every experience to be something people really enjoy. So when I sit in the theater and watch a film, I'm, you know, wondering, are people liking this, right? As I'm watching it, still to this day, I'm wondering if people are liking it. Well, so when I hear that people do, it makes me really happy.
I absolutely loved it. I thank you for making it. And I thank you, Robert Schwartzman, and Colin Blunstone. Thank you so much for spending some time with me again on From the Bookshelf. And I hope you both find some time. I know you're busy today, and I hope you'll find some time to come back and spend some more time with me and talk more.
Brilliant. We'd love to.
Awesome. Thank you. Gary, thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you. Congratulations on the film, and congratulations on the Hall of Fame.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. I would like you to meet Brimond McDougall and Lisa Cooper. They are the founders of a brand new imprint, a new publishing company. Welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. We're so happy to be here.
Happy to have you, and I'm happy to have these books. These books are absolutely beautiful, and I want everybody to know about them. Oh, they're sitting right here.
Oh, nice. You have them in hand. I love it.
And I, you know, I'm a person, and I think people who listen to my program are people also who love books. We like books. We like the way they look. I like that all these books that you've made, they have the same, they fit together. I like the colors that you chose. So I want to find out how it all happened. So let's begin. What the name of your imprint, is that how you call it? An imprint, a publishing company, or what is it?
We call it a publishing company, but I don't know, imprint maybe when you have a big company and you have more, you know, multiple sort of
smaller
imprints. Yeah. We're just small,
but we're a whole publishing empire in and of ourselves.
That's correct. An empire of two.
Yes.
And it's called quite literally books. I like it. And I like the logo. And you, our listeners can probably tell, but I'll just tell them. You are women.
We are.
You started this publishing company, and the books that you publish are by women, and they are books that are out of print. Is that right?
They are by women. They are either out of print or prints that tend to sort of fly below the radar, little known authors or little known books that more famous people have written.
And there are these books that you've always loved, and you said, you know, we need to do this so we can get these books out there. Was that?
No, there are books that are new to us as well. Mm. There are books that we've spent the last 2 or 3 years, I think.
I think it's now closer to 5.
No, but that just sounds so long. We have been reading and reading and reading and finding, you know, looking for things that that grab us and that we really love and want other people to know about. But no, the Homemaker is out in the world a little bit more than Pink House or Plum Bun. You can get copies, but in the U.S., I don't think there's anybody who's printed it lately. Mm-hmm. So that one it's a little more in the world, but still hard to find. And we love it. But the other two, are out of print. I think the last edition of Plum Bun came out in like 1985. Mm. And Pink House has been out of print since the 50s, really since shortly after it was published.
And are any of these authors living? They're all gone.
They're all gone. And they are authors who are quite well known in their day, but for, you know, a bunch of different reasons, really, are largely forgotten today.
So how did you guys come up with the idea of creating a publishing company?
Well, yeah. Because we thought having a bookstore would be too hard, so we decided to just start a publishing company.
Yeah, that seemed reasonable.
Yeah.
As we're into it, it seems crazier and crazier, but here we are. And we are two women that started this, but we were two girls that met each other in middle school and read books and talked about books and loved books. And that has continued for the last very, very many years.
Right. So you met in middle school. You've known each other for 10 years.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Exactly. Yeah. People will be surprised when we go back for our 10-year reunion. So we've known each other and we've talked about books and we sort of during the pandemic, talked more about books and also more about, we both turned 50 and we sort of talked about, you know, what was something that we might really want to do? Mm-hmm. And it just sort of, we came back to this.
Well, books, yeah, were a really foundational part of our friendship, I think. And then thinking about, you know, really intentionally about, you know, what do we do in this next chapter? Sorry, bad pun, of our lives. Like, what do we really want to do? And what do we want to center that around? And reading has always just been, you know, a big deal to both of us. And so we came back to books. We are also both very much into history, mm-hmm. and we love old things. And so we have always enjoyed finding something that, you know, comes to us either through a thrift shop or through, you know, a used bookstore, and sharing those kinds of finds with one another. And yeah, so I think it was kind of an organic process of a lot of conversations, you know, all those really long telephone calls that we all had with old friends during the pandemic. And one day I was sitting there and I said something like, you know, Burr, I just really wish like we could publish our own books. You know, I wish we could do something. We're like bringing like, you know, women authors back to light. And she was like, well, why can't we?
Yeah. Well,
and it was really just that. It was like sort of having this like kind of big, audacious, ridiculous goal.
Yeah, and we've been complimented, and I say that kind of in quotes by people along the way who've said, oh, that's so brave. It's so brave of you to start a publishing company. And we think, oh, is it really? Oh, we weren't trying to be brave. We were trying to do something, you know, interesting and worthwhile. Right. And it turns out that maybe they were right.
Yeah, I mean, and we fear delusion that we believe in strongly, so that helps.
Yeah. Well, Vermon McDougall and Lisa Cooper, you guys have been friends for a long time, and now this is the end of your friendship as you have started this business.
Well, yeah. but that's what the cool part, that's the cool part of the story. That's the next part of the story, mm-hmm. which is we have always thought that like talking about books is one of our favorite things to do, but we don't actually always agree on, you know, what we love about a book or, you know, mm-hmm. our tastes are really different in a lot of ways. And the conversations that come out of the books that we are, you know, publishing or considering publishing have really been, I think, like, sort of pushed our friendship into like a whole nother level of closeness, actually, because a lot of these books, you know, they deal with themes and have language and stuff that is really uncomfortable for a modern reader. And we're having to have lots of like uncomfortable conversations. Well,
and they're the conversations that we hope our readers will have. Yeah. I mean, they're the conversations that we're hoping will get sparked among our readers, because yeah, we've had them.
Yeah.
And
rather than like making things, you know, like difficult between us or whatever, it's like I'm getting to know Bermond in a different way. She's understanding things about me that maybe have been true our whole lives and we never talked about. And yeah. It's really been an amazing, amazing, like, next level pushing, like,
you know, we're still having fun.
Yeah. And I know we make it sound hard, but really we laugh a lot.
We laugh a lot.
Well, in any, you know, piece of culture, I teach film appreciation and I encounter the same thing all the time. And you look at older films and as much as you love them, there are things that in our enlightened world we find, distasteful. But as a matter of fact, pretty much anything in the old movies that didn't bother people now, and the things that would have bothered people then don't bother people now. And I suppose that's probably true of literature as well. So what let's just talk about these three books that you have launched, quite literally books with. And the one that's on the top of my pile is The Pink House by Nelia Gardner White. And who was she, and what is this book?
Nelia Gardner White is not particularly well known. I mean, I don't think she's known at all right now. She was pretty prolific in her day, which was writing in the 40s and 50s. She wrote, I think, 25 novels.
Wow.
She's a prize-winning novelist. She was edited by, I can't remember the man's name, I should have done my homework more, but who referred to her in the same sentence with, you know, with great writers, great male writers of the time.
Yeah.
And
like Saul Bellow.
Yeah, like Saul Bellow. Mm. And so she's just sort of dropped out of mm-hmm. Out of the conversation. This book and most of her books, and perhaps why she's dropped out of the conversation, are about family and home and the interior lives of women. And the interior lives of families, and mm-hmm. that it's not that it doesn't age well. I think it's just not given importance in the same way that mm-hmm. other things are. So The Pink House in particular is about it's very much along the lines of sort of Jane Eyre, that kind of
Rebecca. We say if you like Rebecca, you'll like this.
Yeah. Book. Mm-hmm. But it's a young girl who's orphaned. She's always been, you know, petted and coddled, and she goes to live with her aunt and uncle in their big house with her four cousins who she thinks are going to be their friends. And it turns out that they are not friendly.
No more petting and coddling.
No. And she uses a crutch. So that's a whole, you know, that's a whole other thing as well. And so the book is told from her. She's writing the story, and there are all these sort of undercurrents and secrets and dark things, and she's having to try to figure out what is going on in this house. And it's just, it's a good sort of that kind of, you know, family saga. Mm-hmm. And I love it. I enjoy it.
So it's not mystery or suspense the way maybe Rebecca would be, but it's got mystery to it.
But it does have a sense of mystery because you don't really know what the big secret is. Like, yep. Why is everyone like tiptoeing around something, and why is everyone mad all the time?
Yes.
And, you know, like,
and it has a happy ending.
It does.
It ends well. But yeah, there's a lot of, there's a lot of like, what is happening? Why are these people so unhappy?
Right. And she does a beautiful job, Neelia Gardner White, of like, first of all, getting you invested and in finding out what is going on and then letting it kind of unfold. And it's not a story where it's like super plot driven. It's just sort of like being in the shoes of this narrator who's a watcher and sort of having it all sort of like sink in and you're sort of drawing your own conclusions as you go along with her. It's really well written and it's like Berman likes to call it like a cozy read. Like it makes you want to curl up on a couch and like tuck in with a cup of tea.
And it's the only book that we printed in this first three that was still in copyright. And so we found our way to one of her, to her grandson. Who had wasn't even really very familiar with her work.
Wow.
Said that he'd read a couple of her books when he was in the Army. They had them on the library on the Army base where he was, and he'd read a couple of them. But yeah, he was not, he, you know, so her family's not even particularly versed in her
coolness, her general coolness.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. So. In this is the only one of the three in which you had to worry about the copyright. So did you, you licensed it for your imprint, or how does that work?
Yeah, we got permission to print it.
Yeah, but, and this is something, again,
we don't own the copyright.
We did not understand fully as we started this whole thing how much time this was going to take and how, in some instances, impossible it was going to be to find the heirs, you know, from whom we would need to get copyright or printing permission.
And even sometimes if we find the heirs and for whatever reason, they don't want grandma's book to be reprinted.
Hmm. Well, so you said that Neelia Gardner White wrote something like 20 books. How did you choose The Pink House from her library?
Well, a couple of reasons. Actually, a lot of our research that we do out of the New York Society Library, which is a subscription library here in New York. And they've been around since, I think, 1754. Mm-hmm. And we always joke that they haven't thrown much away. And so they tend to have like incredible collections, but sometimes, you know, obviously not all 30 of her books or whatever. So we start there oftentimes, like, what does the library have? A lot of our research centers around the New York Public and New York Society libraries.
And The Pink House was one of her better known and better selling books.
There's actually another one that we're going to probably print soon that we also really love. But another part of our process is also thinking about how the books fit together. You know, the three that we chose because we feel like they sort of sit well together. This other book that we had of White's is, has another like kind of, sort of a difficult to like mother figure. And we figured that in The Homemaker, which we're happy to talk about in a minute, the mother figure I think is admirable, but she's not always very likable. And we were like, maybe we don't throw out to our readers, you know, too difficult to like mothers. We don't really want to, you know, disparage motherhood in all its different forms.
Brimon McDougall and Lisa Cooper are joining us today, and their new publishing company is called Quite Literally Books, and they've published three books so far. They just were published in the last month or so, and they're lovely books. I'm going to hold them up to the microphone so you can all see them. And I like the cover. They're like some kind of a print, woodcut or something print. Who made that?
Yes.
Who did the artwork on that?
Anthony Russo did the artwork on the covers of these first three. And I love that you noticed that it does look like a woodcut, because we specifically, so here's a really good example of the way Bramond and I go down rabbit holes. We were reading a book, a memoir that we hope someday to publish, but right now we cannot name because we don't have the rights to it. And we're running into a little bit of a brick wall with the heir. But in this memoir, this the woman who's writing the memoir talks about Rockwell Kent, and we had never heard of Rockwell Kent, but we were curious and went down that rabbit hole. It turns out we love his stuff. And so when we showed our book designer, these Rockwell Kent, woodcuts that we thought were incredible, she was like, oh, I have the artist for you. And she put us in touch with Anthony Russo, who produced these incredible, incredible covers. And you're thank beautiful. You for pointing out the way our books look and feel, because a whole lot of time and thought went into the design of these books, because Bermond and I are book lovers, meaning not just the content, but the way a book feels in your hand and looks on the shelf and smells when you open it. So these books were printed in Germany. They are printed on what's called Munken paper, which is incredibly high quality paper that will not yellow with age. We had the books reset. So all the fonts are very legible, even if you are 50 something. And things like, attention to the glue that was used, so that when you open the book, it will lie flat on your table, or you're able to, like, if you're a bathtub reader, you can hold it in one hand. Mm-hmm. And the spine will never crack on you. It will get a lovely patina, as Bermond mm-hmm. likes to say, and will look like it's well read and well loved when it's sitting on a shelf, but it will never fail you. It will always close again. So yes, thank you for noticing.
Well, I'm glad you guys put the amount of care into it. And I also like your logo with this little pair of glasses, and you guys both wear glasses, and glasses are a powerful symbol, and I think right now a meaningful symbol. When Pol Pot took over in Cambodia, one of the first things he did was he rounded up all the people who wore glasses and had them killed, because they were obviously people who read and were intellectuals and a danger to society. So I appreciate the glasses that you've put on the top of each of these books.
Thank you for imbuing that with even more meaning. Yeah, that is like so good that we might need to use that going forward, because you're right. This is a time where, like, this is a conversation that Bermond and I have had, is it possible to do something like this, put books back into print that have, that are from the past and have difficult themes and words and whatnot? Is it possible to do something like that and not be political? And the answer is no. Like, in this day and age, publishing, but even just reading and writing, are political acts. And
a library card is
100%
dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your books are solely physical media. You're not doing an ebook version of your books.
We're not doing an ebook version. Yes.
We're just literally,
yeah, we're quite
books.
Literally,
yeah.
Literally books. We also have a quite literally tote bag, but that's just to carry your book around in. we're very dedicated to the book.
I mean, I think generally when I travel, I half my suitcase is filled up with real books, which is ridiculous, yeah. And I also often have to ship a box of books back home when I go somewhere, because when Lisa and I travel together, oh my goodness, like,
it's ridiculous.
All we do is go to bookstores.
Entire trips are planned around bookstores. Yes.
Well, that's the thing. A book is it's a thing. It's a relic. It's an icon of a moment. It's a thing. Yeah. All right.
I didn't express that very well. My grandmother always gave me books, and both of my grandmothers did. And they wrote in them. They wrote notes to me. And so I have a lot of books that have both of my grandmother's handwriting in them. And some of them, say why the book was special to them, or why they think I would like this book, that's an artifact.
An artifact. That was the word I was looking for. Thank you. My grandmother, who was a pain in the neck, my father's mother, one of the things that she did was she wrote in her books. As she was reading them, she would write in them. And I have a couple of those books that are books I really love. And the things that she wrote were really interesting, and the things that she thought, was worth making a comment about.
Yeah.
It's an insight into,
yeah. Well, if you look in the back of our books, you'll see that we have a few pages at the end that are designated as notes. Because a lot of people don't like to write in their books, but we thought maybe if we just labeled those extra pages as notes, then people will feel a little freed up to, like, you know, put their marginality in there.
Also, speaking of the artifact of a book, I like in my books, in my book collection, and I think you do too, Brimond, I like having a book that looks like it's been read. It doesn't have to be in pristine, perfect condition in a plastic bag. It's kind of cool to see, oh, this book was passed around. A lot of people read this one or carried it in their pocket.
I also have some books on my shelf that you can see that somebody got halfway through, it's a paperback. Yes. And then it gets, it's all bungled up, and then it gets very smooth. And you think,
they didn't quite get through that one.
Didn't quite finish that one.
Who knows why. Books. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So tell me about The Homemaker by Dorothy Canfield Fisher.
You want to hit that one?
No, you go for it.
Okay. All right. So The Homemaker by Dorothy Canfield Fisher is probably the best known of the three books. And is available other places, but we hope that people will buy our edition. It's a really fascinating story that we think really resonates still today about a family, and it's another family story, takes place a lot of it in the home. There's a wife who is a perfectionist homemaker. She does everything just right. She's killing herself. And this is the 1920s. Her children are miserable. It's too much. And her husband is a poet and kind of a dreamer. And he works in the business office of a department store, and he is utterly miserable. He just wants to, do something freer, and he wants to spend time with his children and really know them. And there's just not a way for him to do that. And then there's an accident which forces him to stay at home. And forces, at first, it seems like it's forcing the wife, Eva, to go out into the world and find a job to support them. But it ends up being more of a lets her, because she goes out and finds that she is a crackerjack saleswoman and really is very good at it. She's very good at knowing what other people want and helping other women. She works in a clothing department. And Lester is really good at being a stay-at-home dad. He's really good at interacting with his children and building relationships with his children on a really intimate and sort of fundamental way, in a way that Eva just was not.
It's a hands-on approach.
Yeah.
Oh, and that's an interesting aside, is that Dorothy Canfield Fisher, the author, is the person who's credited with bringing the Montessori method to the United States.
Fantastic.
And you see a lot of that approach to, childcare, child rearing coming through in how Lester approaches, his children. It's a lot of experiential stuff. And one of the things that Brimond and I have been talking about is but isn't it interesting? It's not like maybe one of the reasons why Lester is so successful in this way is because he doesn't have the same parameters that are put on women, who are mothers, especially at this time in the 1920s, like the right and wrong way of raising kids. That didn't really exist for men because there weren't really many stay-at-home dads, right? So he can kind of make it up the way
he's free to do
exactly
kind of whatever. Yeah. And nobody, they're all sort of shocked that he's home and doing this, but they're not really shocked so much
by how
he's doing it.
It's like, oh, isn't that clever? Yeah. Every time he does something out of the box, well, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Whereas if Eva had done it that way, well, it would have been wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
So,
and Eva is able to go out. And this is something that I love about this. She is able to go out guilt-free. And I don't really think I know any women who work and are guilt-free. I think we all struggle with, I wish I could stay home more. I wish I could work more. Like, there's always this tension, and she gets to go out and You know, she leaves the house in the morning. She goes and has breakfast by herself and reads the paper. And then she goes to work and she comes home and the kids are all bathed and in bed and Lester's got dinner ready. And I mean, it's just this sort of complete role reversal. Mm-hmm. And it's really fun to read. And it's interesting because we still don't have that a whole lot. Like that, that's still, I think we have more shared, you know, more families where the workload is closer to 50-50.
Yeah.
But we don't, we still don't have, I think, not in my experience, a lot of men who are just taking on that role of
Lester's the wife and
you know, making the dentist appointments, making sure everybody's got clean socks, you know, all of that sort of stuff. Besides the big stuff.
Mr. Mom. Yeah, well, it sounds like it was really ahead of its time, written in the 20s.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Know, in my house, you know, we have a division of the housework. I do all of it, and she does none of it. Now,
good for her.
You mentioned that you want people to buy your edition of this book, and so I just thought I would address the idea of buying it. You know, if you guys go to the movies, listeners, if two people go to the movies, it will cost you a lot more than it would cost you to buy this book. And the book is at least, I don't know, it looks like it's maybe 10 hours of reading as opposed to 2 hours of Captain America at the movies.
Yeah. I will say, though, in terms of people perhaps looking for our books, so we have made the conscious decision not to sell our books on a certain platform that a lot of people go to buy all kinds of things.
Yes.
And we have done that because we believe in the sanctity of the local independent bookstore. Mm. We are very serious about keeping those in our communities. And so you will, if you want to buy our books, you can come directly to us on our website, which is quite literally books.com. And we will be happy to wrap them very prettily in brown paper packages.
Mm-hmm. We do that ourselves.
We do all ourselves with our four hands, and send them to you. Or you can ask your local independent bookseller to order it for you. It is available through our distributor, Asterism, but you will not find it on certain platforms.
All right. Well, we won't mention them.
Yeah.
Amazon. Now, what about Plum Bun by Jesse Redmond Fawcett?
Plum Bun's a good one.
Plum Bun is a really good book. So it was written the same year as Nella Larsen's Passing, which is a book that I think more people are familiar with. And has sort of a, you know, some of the same themes, but really differs in a number of ways. So the story is about this woman, Angela, who's growing up in Philadelphia. She is very talented, very beautiful. She is light skinned and is oftentimes, mistaken for being white. And as she's growing up, and her family, her mother is also light skinned. She starts to see that there are maybe some advantages to passing. And after her parents both die, she makes this big decision to move to the big city. She moves to New York to pursue a life as an artist and to allow people just to assume she's white. And in doing so, she has to leave behind her community and her sister. And it's a coming of age story. I mean, she's a young woman kind of trying to figure it all out. I think a lot of times when people encounter this book, they may think it's just about passing, but it's really not. It's so much to do with, all the kinds of decisions that even today young women have to make about marriage and career and sexuality and what it means to leave your family, what it means to let someone else tell you what your identity is. It is so current in so many ways. And it is truly a story about intersectionality. And we love this book. And it was interesting because when we first started talking about publishing something by Jesse Redmond Fawcett. She's written four books. We wrestled because we love one of her other books almost as much. But this particular book, I think Britt Bennett has written The Vanishing Half. Like it has
so many similar themes. Caucasia, or actually anything that Danzy Senna has ever written. I mean, these are things that we are talking about today. This book was written 100 years ago, almost, not quite. It is very timeless. And the author, Jessie Redmond Fawcett, was an incredible, incredible person in her own right. So she is considered to be one of the, what do they call her? A midwife?
Midwife, which I think is kind of like telling us we were brave to publish.
I know.
The midwife is never, like, the midwife is, that's not really a compliment a lot of ways.
Midwife of the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah, that means she was kind of there, but...
But she actually was, she was so critical in getting a lot of really important Black authors discovered. She worked side by side with W.E.B. Du Bois on the NAACP's magazine called The Crisis. And during her years there, she launched the careers of people like Langston Hughes and Gwendolyn Bennett. County Collins. Yeah. Just a lot of people that we've heard of and yet we haven't heard of her. Incredible story. And right now, unbeknownst to us when we were publishing this book, right at the same time, a historical fiction account of her book was published by Victoria Christopher Murray, I believe is her name,
and it's
Harlem Rhapsody. And so if you want to have a historical fiction account of the life of Jessie Redmond Fawcett that you read alongside Plum Bun, that's kind of a fun double read.
For your book club.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, all right. So Quite Literally Books has quite literally published 3 books, and there'll be more. How many more, and when will they be here?
3 more coming down. It's already in the production pipeline. They will be out in November this fall.
Fantastic. Well, maybe you'll come back and review those with us. I mean, will you come back and review those with us?
Absolutely. Yes. We love to talk about books all day long, as you can tell.
Well, good. Breemon McDougall and Lisa Cooper are my guests, and their company is called Quite Literally Books, and you can acquire these lovely books by going to, say, Bookshop Santa Cruz and asking them to order them for you, or you could visit quiteliterallybooks.com, and Breemon and Lisa will wrap them in brown paper for you. you guys, it's lovely to meet you, and thank you for being with me on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Gary. This was a pleasure.
So fun.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro.
Joining me now is Lissa Warren. She is the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She is a professor at Emerson College in Boston, and she's active on Twitter at Lissa_Warren. And she joins me here occasionally on From the Bookshelf to talk about books. Lissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gary.
What have you been reading?
I've been reading Wards of the State, and the subtitle is The Long Shadow of American Foster Care. It's published by Abrams Press, and it's written by a journalist named Claudia Rowe. She has been with the Seattle Times for a number of years. Now, the book starts off by acquainting us with a woman named Marianne, and really she was more of a girl than a woman because when we first get to know her, she was 16 years old, and she had been arrested for murder. She had been in and out of foster and adoptive homes since the age of 10, and she'd run away, and she'd been trafficked and assaulted, and she finally pointed a gun at a man who had taken her into his car and pulled the trigger and fled. And with no family to turn to because she was a foster kid and few reliable friends, it did not take long for the police to catch up with her. Now, when author Claudia Rowe first came to know her, it was in the courtroom when she was being sentenced for this murder. And when she was in the courtroom watching this unfold, Claudia Rowe noticed that even the judge seemed to be rather confident that it was not just Marianne who had done something wrong, that it was the system that had in effect raised her, the foster care system. The defense blamed neither the traffickers nor Marianne or even Washington State itself, but really the whole foster care system in America today, which parents thousands of kids every year. So journalist Claudia Rowe, she's an award-winning journalist, she decided she wanted to dig deeper, and she decided to weave Marianne's story in with those of five other foster kids across the country, including an 18-year-old who'd been sleeping on the street in New York City, and a gangbanger turned graduate student, and a foster kid who's now a policy advisor to the White House. He has the coolest name, Sixto Cancel. And she paints a really visceral survival narrative showing exactly where and when and how the system channels these kids into locked cells. She makes a really compelling case that the foster care system is actually, in the United States, a feeder for the prison system. It is a heartbreaking book, but it's also surprisingly hopeful because Claudia Rowe comes up with solutions of how we can make the foster care system better. And one of those solutions is a thing called kinship care, which is where you find a relative, even if it's a distant relative, who the child knows who can be in their life and take care of them. And you provide that person with the resources they need to parent that child. And it is so much better for it to be someone that they are related to, someone who they know, instead of a stranger who is raising them. And that makes a huge, huge difference. And she also advocates for increasing the age in which you age out of the foster care system, because that too can make a really big difference in these kids' lives. So she has some concrete solutions. It's not an easy read. It's not a light read, but it's an important read, and it is a motivating read because there are things that we can do and we can do better.
Well, true crime is such a popular genre, and this seems like true crime that is worthwhile rather than just lurid.
Yeah, it's not, you know, salacious in any way. I mean, you get to know these kids, you feel for these kids, and then she sort of casts a wider net and shows us how they are emblematic of some fundamental flaws in the system, and point the way to what needs to be done to improve it.
Well, it sounds interesting. I want to ask a couple more questions. So,
sure.
When she wants this children who are wards of the state to remain wards of the state for a longer period of time until they're past 18. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, they age out of the system at 18. Like, they're, you know, kicked to the curb, basically. Like, the foster parents no longer get any funding to help raise the kids. And so a lot of the foster parents, unfortunately, abandon them once they stop being a revenue for income, a revenue driver. And so if you increase it from 18 to, you know, 20, 22, something like that, that can mean that kids are older and better able to take care of themselves financially and emotionally by the time that they are turfed by the system. And that would make a huge difference. I mean, at 18, there's no way that most kids, including myself, could have fended for themselves. But at 22, maybe you have a shot at it. Maybe by then you've, you know, got a steady job and some income coming in, and you can afford your own apartment, even if it's not fancy, and that way you're not ending up on the streets. So, yeah, she advocates for increasing the age. Makes a lot of sense, I think.
And what role does race play in children who are wards of the state, if any?
Well, it is a higher number of African-American kids and Latino kids in the foster care system than Caucasian kids. That's a fact. That's for sure. But you can't just look at race when looking at this issue. And, you know, it's issues that need to be solved for everyone, I think Claudia would say, with due regard to the fact that there are some underserved communities that are even more poorly served by the foster care system, for sure.
That sounds fascinating to me. Wards of the State, The Long Shadow of American Foster Care by Claudia Rowe.
You got it. Yep. She's amazing. She's such a brilliant woman.
Yeah. You're working with her. You're enjoying it.
Yeah, I'm working with her, and she has written for the New York Times and Mother Jones magazine, which is a really good progressive magazine. She was nominated for a Pulitzer for a story that she did on Latino youth gangs. She's a top-notch journalist, really, really good journalist, good reporter.
Well, thanks for telling us about it, Lissa. It sounds really good, and we always appreciate it when you join us here on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.